सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। टुडे वी आर गोइंग टू टर्न टू अ होली न्यू टॉपिक एंड अ वेरी इंटरेस्टिंग टॉपिक एज फार एज आई कैन सी। टू पीपल, वन फ्रॉम लम्स, वन एन एक्स वर्ल्ड बैंकर, आई विल इंट्रोड्यूस देम टू यू सून, हैव रिटन अ वंडरफुल बुक, एन ऑप्टिमिस्टिक बुक which is a rarity in Pakistan. The book is called Candles in the Dark, and it's about islands of excellence in an otherwise problematic governance structure in Pakistan that all of you are familiar with. So I have with great difficulty roped these two gentlemen to educate us on their research. They spent a year writing this book, and the book has been well received in reviews and things. So let me introduce my guests. I have first Mahmood Ali Ayub. Mahmood Ayub is a famous name in development economics around the world. He has worked extensively in development issues, I would say, over the last 30-35 years. He has a PhD from Yale, a very good educational background, and he's worked for the World Bank for many, many years. He worked in many, many positions in the World Bank. He worked in many different areas. He was in Latin America. He was in the Middle East. He was in Africa. And he rose to a very senior position in the World Bank. And then decided, as people do in their careers, to move on to the UNDP, where he was appointed as a senior resident representative or the director of the UNDP in Turkey, which is, as you know, a most important country. So welcome, Mahmood. It's wonderful to have you on Soch Bichar.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, my second guest is also equally accomplished, though younger, but equally accomplished, is Turab Hussain. Turab is the chairman of the Department of Economics of LUMS. And I don't think I need to say more. LUMS is a prestigious institution, and Turab is the chairman of the department, a rising star in that institution. He is now an associate professor. Turab has a PhD from Essex, has worked extensively in areas of development economics, international trade, and generally growth and development economics. Turab is, as I said, an important figure to watch in the future. So welcome, Turab.
Thank you very much, Nadeem Saab. It was very flattering.
Now, tell me, folks, Candles in the Dark. What are you going to tell us about these candles? Because I'm dying to learn about them. So who will begin, Mahmood, you or Turab?
I can begin, and sure. Turab will add on.
Go ahead.
If that's okay.
Go ahead.
So, Nadeem, the idea basically is to ask the question, how is it that in a country like Pakistan, where the institutions are weak and in some ways deteriorating, that we still have some organizations, some institutions that seem to do well? So the book tries to answer the question, what are the success factors behind the ability of these institutions to be successful even in a very challenging environment that is Pakistan? Now, before we begin the work, we had to ask ourselves, what do we mean by success? And there we used three criteria. First, results. In other words, to what extent do the institutions achieve the results, the goals that they set up for themselves? The second is legitimacy. To what extent are the institutions found useful by the key stakeholders, by the key stakeholders. And the third one is sustainability, resilience. In other words, you can have an institution that's successful for a few days or a few weeks, but of course you need the the performance to be long-lastingly successful over a certain period of time, let's say 5 years or the time horizon of one leadership turnover. And here we look at possibilities of how the institution can, if it was set up with foreign investment or foreign aid, to what extent has it moved away towards being independent of it. I can discuss later on the factors for success, but this is roughly an outline of what I was going to say.
Okay, so you're saying basically it's resilience, meeting certain objectives, and efficiency in operation.
That's right.
Is that a good summary of the three
good
objectives?
Good summary.
Okay, fair enough. Turab, how would you see that?
Gee, so this is absolutely correct. So in the selection of institutions, as Mahmood Saab pointed out, these were the three major factors which were used, or you can say metrics of success which were used. We ended up looking at 9 institutions. And what is interesting about this study is that out of the 9 institutions looked at, 6 of them are actually in the public sector. Essentially, we're covering the social sector. You have institutions in education. You have a hospital. You have a social insurance. You have an education voucher scheme, which is the Punjab Education Foundation. In education, we have Lahore University of Management Sciences. We have IBA, so both the private and the public sector. We have motorway police. We have Rescue 1122, which is a public sector organization of the provincial government. We also have EDI Foundation, which is again in the private sector. So it's a mix of different types, but out of these 9, there are 6. And in having these public sector organizations, we, in a sense, counter the received wisdom that normally public sector in developing countries is ridden by rent-seeking, corruption is generally inefficient. So we come up with cases where actually things have not quite regressed to the mean, and these public sector organizations have actually performed fairly well. And by doing these case studies, by writing these case studies, we try and figure out what the major reasons were.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, we've got your the reasons by which you picked these 9 institutions, and it's wonderful that you've got 6 public sector and 3 private sector institutions. Yeah. And I think generally everybody would agree with you that these institutions are the better ones. So I don't think there would be any query there. But give me an idea of the framework that you're using for making this analysis.
Okay, so there's a very large body of literature on institutional economics, you know, started by the famous Douglas North, a very famous book which came out some years ago by Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson. So, and then that's on institutional economics, and there's also this literature on a new sub-discipline which is emerging in organizational economics. So our framework is in some sense an intersection of these two sub-disciplines. So we're looking at organizational success in a weak external or institutional environment. So where laws, rules, customs and norms are such which are not quite inclusive or not quite conducive to the functioning of organizations which might be in the public sector or the private sector. Now, there's a large literature on organizations. So within that, we're focusing on those organizations in the private sector which are not for profit. So if you look at sort of the standard firm industrial organizations or organizational literature, that's very, very large. So we don't touch that. So we're limiting ourselves in the private sector for not-for-profit, social sector organizations, and of course, public sector is not-for-profit. So that is in some background of the framework where we're coming from. The methodology which we use is also a bit different. It's, so we came up with a structured interview, a questionnaire, which was used at different levels of these organizations, different tiers of management, going all the way up to the top. And these were then used to write these cases. And from these cases, you draw out what are the major attributes or elements which lead to the success or have led to the success of these organizations. So that's simply the framework and the methodology which has been used in this case.
Mm-hmm. So you use a questionnaire to try and get an idea of what? How these organizations are managed?
How these organizations function. How are these, in a sense, what are the rules, the procedures, what's the history of these organizations, what are the problems which they have faced, how do they interact with government, with various departments of the government, and also how have they been able to insulate themselves from government pressure, especially for those which are part of the public sector. So these were the critical questions which then helped us in ascertaining what the key factors of success were.
Now tell me, when you look at these 9 organizations, so what are the key lessons that you derive from your study?
Okay, so Mahmood Saab, you and I can both, I can start off perhaps and you can add on.
Let me begin by...
Yeah, you can begin.
Yeah. Basically, there are several factors that come out as success factors. The first one is clear objectives and goals, that the institution should have objectives that are very clear and monitorable, whether it is in the case of LUMS or IBA or Rescue 1122, that they are simple to measure and therefore, you know, one can see whether the success has been achieved. The second one is attracting and retaining skilled staff. That in all these cases, they have been able to attract and retain skilled staff or students or faculties. This helps tremendously in cutting down on costs of turnover, costs of training, and so on. The third one is financial sustainability, that in almost all these cases, over time they have become fairly self-reliant on their own resources. LUMS, for example, tuition now covers something like 60 to 70% of the total costs. Similarly, IBA, slightly lower tuition coverage, but then they have some money coming from the government, 10% or so. So that's financial sustainability. And finally, among the larger issues, managerial autonomy and political support. To what extent are the institutions allowed managerial autonomy by the owners, by the government? And this is extremely important, that the board of directors should be fairly independent and strategic in its thinking, and that the institution should have support, political support, where it's needed, as in the case of Benazir Income Support Program, which was started, the ideas were started at the time of General Musharraf, and it became developed under Benazir, under PPP, and it was given further support by the present government. So these are some of the factors.
Mm-hmm. Turab, you want to add any?
Yes, so another important one, and that is perhaps true for almost all of these organizations, is, as was mentioned, this initial leadership, and which is critical. And another thing which is attached to that is also, if you look at these organizations, these are innovative organizations. In a sense, they were perhaps the first ones to come up with a unique service. You look at the example of Rescue 1122. You know, although you had various ambulance services, you had ED out there, but theirs was the first one which gave medical aid, emergency aid in the ambulance. So the ambulance was equipped with sort of basic treatment, and then the first one to maintain the 7-minute response time. If you look at the case of IBA, for example, in the 1950s-60s, first in terms of starting an MBA program, LUMS first, essentially a liberal arts undergraduate program. If you look at the case of Benazir Income Support Program, again, a social welfare, the scale it is at the federal level, the first one, Nadra the first, Punjab Education Foundation, public-private partnership a first. So these were, in some sense, innovative social entrepreneurship led by very visionary leadership. Now, the critical thing is, which makes it an institution, and in a sense, the onus is on that leadership to come up with then protocols, processes, and procedures, which then are not dependent on then one person. So till the end, after the end of the person's tenure, these institutions can keep on delivering the service. So that is very critical. So how does that initial leadership translate into institutional building? So that was also very critical.
Mm-hmm. For example, Nadeem, in the case of rules and procedures, in the case of IBA, Ishrat Hussain made it a very important point of making sure that the rules and procedures are all codified in one place so that you can access that information at any time by anyone.
Let me ask you a question. I mean, quite frequently, I mean, I think you mentioned this issue of sustainability, which is very important, resilience and financial independence. But quite often what I've seen in Pakistan is that we celebrate success too early. And we also celebrate success on the basis of our own little big fish and small pond syndrome. That these organizations may not be competitive in an international framework, but we celebrate them because they're competitive on a local framework. Have you dealt with that issue or not? Are these big fishes in small pond, or are they actually internationally competitive success stories?
Well, I think generally one is looking at them within the context of Pakistan. Okay. So in that sense, you can say it's a small pond. But if you look at IBA and LUMS, they are competing with other international universities, and you know, they're ranked among the top 200 or whatever institutions. So they are competing. They're trying to meet the criteria to be put on that list.
I think that, but that's also a critical challenge, really. I mean, although LUMS is one of the premier and so is IBA institutions in the country, how do you make it internationally competitive? And also the big challenge here is, and also one of the things which we clearly state in our study, is that there is, of course, a degree of fragility whenever you talk about institutions. And the case to read is that of IBA. IBA in 1950s, 60s, 70s, you know, it was a very good university with great reputation, with very good faculty. It made a name regionally also. But then things, you know, changed. And 1990s, you had a decade of decline where IBA lost its excellence and its reputation till Ishrat Hussain took over and then changed things for the better. So you have institutions which have gone down and have improved again. So there's no guarantee, and that's and the fragility is precisely because of that hostile environment in which these organizations are.
But then let me also look at this. You said that it's also very important that the initial leadership, this is almost going back to the Weberian charisma issue, or even I think James Wilson in Bureaucracy has also mentioned that the initial leaders play a very big role in terms of setting up organizations.
That's right.
But the issue then is that what happens once the charismatic leader is gone? Are these organizations capable of sustaining themselves or not?
Interestingly, in most of these organizations, the ones which we have covered, perhaps there are two or three of them which are actually going through that change. So I'll give you examples. So EDI Foundation. Now, EDI Foundation, let me just state, is very anomalous because it defies all the standard criteria of success within sort of corporate governance or organizational theory. It's very centralized, very non-transparent. Decisions were done in a very opaque manner by literally a family, one person. But it was very successful. You know, it's a black box. To understand how EDI works is really difficult. There's not much data available. Financial auditing, nothing like that. Now it's going through that transition. Now, EDI, for because of his personal charisma, because of the fact that there was social credibility, because of years and years of service delivery, there was no shortage of funds. Now that organization is going through a transition. So we have to wait and see how things change things happen in that organization, whether it can maintain the level of service delivery as it used to in the past. Another organization which has gone through a similar change is Rescue 1122. The person who actually came up with this idea was Dr. Rizwan Nasir, who served as a director general for many years. Mm-hmm. Now, he's no more the director general. There's a new DG, so we have to see how the organization works. Likewise, in the public sector, there have been changes. There have been changes in Punjab Education Foundation, in Benazir Income Support Program. These have weathered the changes fairly well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these organizations are not that old. They're going through that first transition. But for some of them, the signs are positive. For others, we have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you another question. If you think about it, the other important sort of idea that you have there is that they have to have institutional independence, especially from the government. And they also have to have the ability to insulate themselves from the government.
Yes.
How did they manage that? I mean, in the case of LUMS, I can see that. In the case of ED, I can see that. The private sector, I can see that. The public sector organizations, how is it managed?
I'll give you one example, and perhaps Mahmood Saab then can give others also. Rescue 1122 was very interesting. And I asked, it was part of the questionnaire, we asked the specific question how they were able to insulate themselves. So normally, as you know much better than we do, public sector organizations, the first type of interference is in terms of employment, you know. So they feel that this is a place where you can employ people, you know. So you have standard constituency politicians trying to influence the organizations. So what Dr. Rizwan Nasir did was, so they had an academy, the Rescue 1122, they formed an academy, in parallel with the organization. That academy had a training program and there was an entry test. Everything was very transparent. So if there was any political pressure put on him, he used to just say, all right, here's the test. If they qualify this very basic test, IQ test, physical test, they can become part of that academy, go through 1 or 2 years of very rigorous training. If they're able to pass that training, then they are inducted in that organization. So the way it was set up through that training mechanism was a way by which they could filter or they could check that political pressure. That's just one example. For Rescue 1122.
Right. In the case of Benazir Income Support Program, for instance, initially the way the allocations were selected was that the members of parliament, federal as well as provincial, were given X number of amounts that they could allocate. So it was a very not a good way of doing it. And to get away from that, the BISP, Benazir Income Support Program, worked with the World Bank to develop a poverty scorecard, and then the allocations were made based on very detailed data according to the needs of the population.
Okay, so you're saying basically that it's the managerial issue, that if we have clear rules and managerial goals, then it can be done. But can I ask you, is that not how the civil service is set up, and that we have a clear exam, that we have clear rules of promotion, etc.? Then why is the civil service not doing so well?
I think it's also a matter of what we saw in these organizations was that, again, these, as I said earlier, were in some sense the first to provide a service like that. So they were social entrepreneurs who came up with this idea. I mean, most of these, at least in the public sector, are cases. The initial years of success resulted in a degree of credibility, which also then instilled within an organization a culture of service delivery. That's, I think, critically important that culture of service delivery, because it makes that organization run more efficiently and also in some sense helps insulate that organization. I mean, I've heard in various meetings and with sort of politicians, government, bureaucrats about Rescue 1122 that, you know, here's an organization which does fairly well and one should not touch it. One should let it be. It's a good organization and so on. So in some sense, its reputation of service delivery over the years protects it. Motorway police is also an example of that. So that credibility which they help sort of establish, the internal culture which they have, again, in some sense, insulates them from all this political interference.
I think also, Nadeem, if you look at civil service of Pakistan, at least in its earlier years, until the time of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, it was a fairly good service. The quality of the civil servants was very good. And it was not subjected to too much political control and political interference. Mm-hmm. Starting with Bhutto, unfortunately, the civil service was decimated in that sense because people were fired based on politics. New people were brought in who were not selected on meritocracy. The objectives of the civil service became less clear. They were not able to attract and retain skilled people. You know, people stopped applying for civil service, which at one time was the place to be in the country. Mm-hmm. So it also depends, in this case, on how the government, in a sense, made the situation worse.
So, gentlemen, what do we learn from your study in terms of permeating this excellence into the rest of Pakistan?
Mehmood Sahab, would you?
You go ahead.
In some sense, I mean, it's, you know, I think the major lesson, and this is for the public sector perhaps, is that, you know, this notion that, you know, there's always this government failure in public sector in developing countries because of the fact that you have a corrosive external environment is bound to fail, or government failure is inevitable and things would regress to the mean. So these are exceptions. And if you look at the reasons why these were successful, in some sense, these could be a rough blueprint. You know, I don't want to say a blueprint for success, because, you know, these do depend on individual cases, environments, time, all that. But in some sense, it's a rough blueprint of success. And you can have a well-functioning, efficient public sector. So that's the major message which comes out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's my take.
Mm-hmm. But let me look, Turab, Mehmood. I mean, we know from the rest of the world that the public sector can be a success. I mean,
yeah.
In many countries, the public sector organizations.
Sure.
And I think this woman just has written a very nice book, Mascuto, on the success of the public sector and how the public sector can be entrepreneurial too. So that is not an issue. The question is, Pakistan has a deep governance failure. And Turab, you also said something just now which I don't quite agree with. You said the private sector is okay. But I think, quite frankly, wouldn't you say that the private sector also has a deep managerial failure? If I look at the top, 100 companies in Pakistan,
mm-hmm.
they're all family run.
Mm-hmm.
They have very little professionalization in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you take out the multinational, there's hardly any professionalization at all. Mm-hmm. And the board members there are, you know, there's conflicts of interest everywhere. They're sitting on each other's boards, and the boards are really not functioning as corporate governance entities. So there's a managerial failure in the private sector too.
Yes. No, I agree with you. I think it's relative. I mean, the general notion, and not specific to Pakistan, is that at least in developing countries, public sectors have gone through. You have examples of Korea and Taiwan where you had fairly well-functioning public sector. But generally, the notion is that, you know, public sectors are rent-seeking, they're corrupt. You have all sorts of issues. There's lack of service delivery. So in comparison to the private sector, although, yes, you're right, in your private sector, you know, your firms, you have the satya culture, you have problems in corporate governance, conflict of interest, those are all there. So the private sector is not devoid of all these ills and problems.
Exactly. And even in the public sector, you know, I have another issue there. See, when I look back, Mahmood, you'll remember it too. Turab is younger, so he may not. There was a time when WAPTA was a center of excellence.
Right.
I mean, it used to be a great organization. Mm-hmm. In fact, Mahmood, you'll bear witness to the fact that WAPTA actually exported its engineers to the World Bank.
Yeah.
And they set up the, you know, World Bank engineering departments.
Absolutely.
So we had that situation. Let's call it, WAPDA was probably the 1122 of the 1960s, right? And then WAPDA declined. Same thing, for example, railways. Railways used to be a very efficient, very good organization. And then that declined too. So I think in one sense, maybe you should do a follow-up book to try and look at the declines too. Why did the declines happen and where did the declines, you know, what were the factors that led to those declines?
Right.
Would you have something to say about that through your
candidate? Well, I think on this one, Nadeem, it's some point that came up in wherever we had book readings, this question was brought up. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something hopefully we will be able to look at in another study. But it's true that there are... It also makes sense to look, instead of just looking at the successes, also to look at some failures. Mm-hmm. Now, in our study, we did look at two enterprises that are not doing so well. One is railways, the other is PIA. And I think I don't know if we also looked at steel.
No, we didn't. We looked at PIA.
These were the two ones. And really, in the end, you come up to the same conclusions, the factors for failure pretty much the same, that there was complete government control over firing and firing of people, overstaffing, PIA having, you know, X number of employees for just one plane, and railways has a labor force of something like 80,000, of whom many stay at home and get paid for doing nothing.
Yeah,
and these are structural reasons. I mean, you see, you can't fix railways by importing brand new Chinese engines, you know. So, and you look at those structural reasons which led to the decline. You know, you had an independent railway board. You had professionals working there. As soon as it was merged into railway ministry, you had you opened the organizations to political patronage pressure, leading to things like overstaffing. You had railway routes, you had railway stations built purely ad hocly for political motives. There was no economic rationale behind it. The way railways is, you talk to the finance department, if you ask them whether a particular route or a particular railway service is feasible or not, is it making money, they won't have that information. So we've documented that decline to some extent in a chapter on failing institutions.
Well, I mean, look, this is a standard fact that most of us say all over the world, that if you make a ministry, you kill an organization.
Yeah.
You immediately politicize it, and that's certainly true. And when I was in the government, we tried to break the railway out of the ministry, but it won't work. But again, Mahmood, you're right. PIA was a very successful organization.
Absolutely.
And PIA, the standard myth is that PIA built up Emirates and Egypt Air and so many other airlines, and now PIA is nowhere and those airlines are there. Exactly. So I accept your point. It's absolutely correct. And this is something that, you know, I used to write about in the 90s. Very simple proposition. I still have that article somewhere. Decentralize, professionalize, autonomize. Those are three words I can't. Mm-hmm. Decentralize, professionalize, autonomize. Isn't that what it amounts to, what you're saying? That we just need to decentralize, professionalize, and autonomize our civil service and our government organizations for them to work?
I think these are three very important items to take care of. Yes, absolutely.
Because right now, the way I look at it is, for example, I don't know whether you guys have studied or not, the entire government is configured to be ruled by about five secretaries. Mm-hmm. Those five secretaries run every department because they are the principal accounting officers. And the principal accounting officers are responsible for everything under their ministry. They rule like rajas in the ministry. Mahmood, mm-hmm. you know the World Bank budget was decentralized down to the division chief level.
That's right.
And here the budget is entirely in the hands of the secretary. Not only the budget of the organization or the department they control, but also of the attached departments. So there is this myth that we have attached departments. For example, PIE is an attached department of the Ministry of Defense. I have sat at meetings where the Secretary Defense talks on behalf of the PIA to the Prime Minister, the Managing Director sitting at the back. Now, what would your argument, your line, would, for example, LUMS work that way, Turab, if we have...
No, absolutely not. I mean, one of the reasons why LUMS is successful is because the management committee, for example, I mean, if you take it as... in a sense, as the one which owns LUMS, is has decentralized a lot of governance to the faculty council. So, and to the professionals, really, to the academics, so to speak. So that's one of the reasons why it is successful. So you have a visionary like Sayyid Babar Ali, but he doesn't control any. He's decentralized to people who know how a university is run, and what is academia all about. So I think this is critical, decentralization, autonomy, and having professionals run an organization. And the public sector organizations which we covered have exactly these features. So, you know, going back to the lessons learned, if ever we go through a civil service or government reform, I think they should look at such organizations which have these attributes and perhaps mold or try to mold the government in that direction.
Now, tell me another thing. What are the kind of books, and I mean, since we do this for students and thinkers, what are the kind of books and articles that influenced you in writing this book?
Okay, Mahmood Sahab, would you like to? Because it was his idea. I really liked it, so we can talk about it, perhaps.
Well, there were a number of books, but the book that really influenced me initially was a manuscript which was done for the World Bank on a similar basis, but multi-country study. Then there was also, as Turab mentioned, Ajimolu and Robinson's Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity and Poverty. I think that also had an influence on the book. I'm trying to remember. Well, I think one has to go through the list at the back of the book to see what really.
There's a very large literature on it, but as Mahmood Sahab said, as far as organizational economics is concerned, this is fairly new as a subdiscipline emerging within economics. But within institutional economics, you know, authors like, or economists, thinkers like Douglas North, Darren Etchemoglu, James Robinson, this Nations Fail, I think it's a brilliant book. As I said, we do something very different. We're looking at sort of organizations within a weak institutional setting. But I think for students, there's a lot of growing literature within organizational economics. And obviously, there's a lot of very, very interesting literature in institutional economics out there. And they can start off with North and James Robinson and Etchemoglu.
So finally, now tell me, what directions of reform would you suggest to... addressing a weak institutional problem? As you keep saying that we are in a weak institutional setting, what are the directions of reform that the two of you would suggest?
Well, I think specifically and in a more general way, these would be essentially any institution that the government owns or the private sector owns, to make sure that there are very clear objectives which are laid out easily, and there are benchmarks which are easily monitorable. Okay. Similarly, to make sure that there is a lot of effort is made to attract and retain skilled staff, whether it still could be skilled students, but or faculty. And also if there is, yeah, and managerial autonomy, of course, is absolutely critical, that there should be a arm's length arrangement between the agency and the owner. So these are some of the things that...
And just let me add, because you're talking about the public sector here, I think some of these organizations...
Also the private sector, Tora, by public
sector.
Or the
private sector. So
because as we talked about it, the private sector itself is no angel in our country.
So in terms of getting the right people, you know, you're talking about sort of incentives within an organizations are also very, very important. You know, you have performance-based salary schemes. You know, you have, with that, you also have monitoring of workers, which is important. So if both things are there, you monitor the performance. At the same time, you also, you know, incentivize them by sort of paying for extra or giving bonuses on performance. So I think that's critical. And also at the same time, once you have a positive culture in an organization, that, so there are non-monetary ways by which you can also, in some sense, keep the organization or keep the personnel in the organization performing well. So these are all critical factors, I feel, which can lead to a successful either public or private organization.
Right. So when you look at, for example, the motorway police, it is really quite incredible when you compare it to the regular police, the corrupt police in the country. And of course, one factor clearly is the salaries are a little higher, 20% or so, 25% higher. But I think it's more than that. It's the training that they're given. It's the responsibility they're given. They're also taught to be strict on giving tickets out, but be absolutely courteous. So it's really, it's almost a pleasure to get a ticket from these people. So if it can be done at the level of motorway police, presumably it can be expanded to the rest of the country's police.
Motorway police I have a little bit of a problem with. It's too narrow an organization. It's a very small organization on a strip of road where we are only measuring its success by one yardstick, which is the ability to give tickets. It is well known that the motorway police is not able to safeguard the motorway in terms of it being a limited access highway. It's supposed to be a limited access highway, and now there are frequent accidents. In fact, I remember one IG or something was had an accident there because people now are coming onto the motorway on a regular basis, and the motorway police are so focused on the tickets that they're forgetting that the safety of the people is not as much dependent on the speed as it being a limited access highway. If you have cows and people crossing the street, there would be a problem. And I think there, the in fact, what has happened is something that we've seen in organization theory before, that if you focus, and behavioral economics has brought it out very clearly, if you focus too narrowly on one objective, which may be not critical to the functioning of that thing, you may have adverse behavior. And I think motorway police has kind of set up that kind of a behavior. Do you see that elsewhere too?
Well, even in this case, Nadeem, I would say that it is not just limited to giving tickets. They have in their portfolio of responsibilities, safety is extremely important. Now, obviously, they can't completely help it if cows start crossing the motorway, there are no barriers. But by and large...
No, Mahmood, that's not correct. There is a barrier has been built.
Right.
That's the whole point of the motorway. I mean, if you look at the motorway is here, it's the same in Pakistan. There is a barrier there. What these people do is they cut the barrier and cross
right.
it. And that's what the motorway police needs to do is monitor the barrier. It's
sure.
not very difficult to do. It's only about 200 kilometers. And if they're not so focused on the tickets, they could monitor the wall. And if somebody is cut into it, they could go and repair the wall. And
right.
catch those people or something. But the motorway police are so narrowly focused on tickets, and we applaud that because we applaud only that. We don't worry about the safety factor. So it's kind of a distorted incentive.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting because, I mean, when we were looking at motorway police, you know, this point was raised that it's a narrow strip and, you know, their interaction with the society at large is in some sense limited. So that again insulates it. But then it has a very narrow aim. So what you're saying is that it needs to broaden its aim and look at these things also, which is in fact part of its mission statement, and they have been doing it. If they've been failing to do it, that's obviously something which needs to be recognized and rectified.
I think it's a standard dictum in behavioral economics that you'll see from work of many people, that if, like for example, in Wall Street, they were so focused on bonuses, that they didn't care about the long-term sustainability of their enterprise. It's the same thing with the motorway police. They're so focused on giving tickets because people applaud them on tickets, because everybody says, oh my God, they're doing a great job giving tickets. But they forget that on a 200-mile strip, you know, if they only run their car, I mean, on 50 miles each and just look at the wall, they'll be able to monitor that nobody comes. Because remember, the whole philosophy of the highway is that it has to be only cars and nothing else. Because if something else comes in, obviously the lives of the people in the car as well as the lives of those on the road are in jeopardy. And that is a failure of the old GT road. So anyway, that's one thing. It's the same thing, for example, in other areas.
Comparing it to GT road, for example, as far as safety is concerned, there's no question that the motorway police or the results on the highway are much better than on GT road.
But I don't think you can make that comparison, Mahmood. Can you, Turab?
Between the GT road and
I don't think you can make that comparison.
No, but you can say that one is a little more safe. I would rather be driving on motorway rather than on GT road.
Motorway police, now its ambit extends to all these national highways. So it's there, and which makes its task even more difficult, because GT road is a completely different beast altogether.
Right.
It was not, I mean, you have population all around it. You don't have, if you look at Punjab, for example, you'll have really areas where you have just the motorway. You have small towns and so on, which create other hazards and problems. So I think, yes, comparing the motorway M2 with National Highway and how motorway police addresses those are two very different things in that sense.
But, you know, again, the same thing, I would say, Turab Mahmood, applies to BISP, for example. BISP also is distributing this money on the basis of scorecard. And we have very little idea of how well or badly it's doing. Yes, it's doing it. And we keep hearing all kinds of rumors, which we don't know. But you have obviously studied it, and you think that it has done well, and we can ratify that it is reaching the people it's supposed to reach, and that is the poverty scorecard is well cited.
Right.
And that it has a game plan for exit of these people.
Yes, basically, it's as far as the targeting is concerned, it is basically state of the art, which was done with the World Bank, and in fact, they're trying to emulate it in other countries. Now, as far as the exiting is concerned, of course, it is based on the income of the lady who is receiving it and her family, and if their income goes above that, then it's cut accordingly.
There's another thing which they have. There are other schemes, by the way. It's not just an income transfer now. You have Wasila-e-Rozgar, you have Wasila-e-Taleem, you have Wasila-e-Sehat. So these are conditional transfers. So the first thing which they started was the unconditional transfer of around 1,500 rupees per household. But now they have these conditional transfers. So you have Wasila-e-Rozgar, for example, which is giving them small loans so that they can start some sort of a small business. There's also skills training attached to it. And the whole idea is to let these poor families graduate out of this dependency.
And Wasila-e-Taleem, for example, the family is given the money on the condition that they will put this child in school.
But folks, I also want to sort of tell you that there is a fair amount of skepticism on these Wasilas. I mean, should the BISP be doing these things, or should it not? And that comes to the core of the problem again, that we count these things as success. And based on that success, what happens is similar things happen to WAPTA and PIEA and railways, that there's mission creep then. People try and reach for more than they should. And eventually what it does is the organization collapses on itself, and the government also wants to them to do different things, and these guys reach out and say, yes, sir, I'll do it. And it eventually leads to the collapse of the organization.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point you've raised, and we do mention it, that, you know, there's one of the criteria of success, or one of the, is stick to the knitting. You know, you have a stated goal, it might be narrow, but sticking to it, you know, increases the probability of sustained success.
That's right.
But the problem is, of course, that once you have a successful organization, then the pressure is for them to do other stuff. So that is true for BISP. That is also, in fact, true for 1122. So 1122, as I said, started off as a fully equipped medical emergency ambulance service, and it was asked to take care of fire emergency also. Then they had to train their workers, their employees, in controlling fire hazards, all that. So now they are doing fire safety, and they have fire extinguishing services also.
And in the case of BISP, there is, in fact, a lot of thinking going on precisely, Nadeem, along the lines that you're thinking. Should it go into these other areas? Because already conditional cash transfers is a good idea, but in many cases, it may defeat the purpose of the conditionality. For example, in my village in Parachinar, you say to the lady of the house, we will give you 1500 rupees if you put your daughter or child or son in school. I think it'll be, there are so many other factors that inhibit the children from being put in school that it may not make sense for them.
I think, you know, you've done some excellent work, and let me just say that, quite frankly, the last question that I have for you is, will candles in the dark lead to daylight everywhere, or will these candles in the dark, like all candles, die?
Right. Well, the first point to make, Nadeem, is that these are 9 candles, if you like. And of course, we didn't have sufficient time to take more successful cases, and there are many. Luckily, there are others also. So it's more than just the few candles. But more importantly, the question will be, how can this be scaled up? The lessons that are obtained here, how can these be scaled up to other institutions?
Can they be scaled up? Do you think they can be scaled up?
As I said, these can be treated as, in some sense, a blueprint of success. If you have within the public and the private sector, as you mentioned, decentralization, autonomy, professionalism, if you look at these three very broad attributes and you work on these, so you can scale it up. You can have a well-functioning public sector, and you can have perhaps a more efficient, more competitive private sector too.
Then basically what you're saying is something similar to what I tried to put forward in the framework of economic growth, and what I've been trying to say for a long time, that the priority should be a civil service reform based on the principles of decentralization, autonomization, professionalization, and the fourth very important, monetization and transparent forms of payment.
Yes,
we can do these four things, we can transform the civil service and a weak institutional structure into a strong institutional structure. Right now, our civil service does not allow skills into the setup because of the fact that they will not allow any professional entry into the system. You enter the system at age 26, And after that, you can never enter, right? Yes. So if you've acquired a professional skill like Turab, you've acquired a PhD and you've done this so much, now you can never be finance secretary, whether you like it or not. Mahmud Ali Ayub, despite all that he's done, can never be finance secretary ever. It's period, right? He cannot be a secretary in the government of Pakistan. So it's that. So I think, quite frankly, let me put it this way. I think I agree with you. I think you've done a wonderful job. And if you, I mean, as you've obviously surveyed the literature and done everything, these principles come out very clearly in organization theory, all the way from Holmstrom and Stiglitz and, you know, various other people. Then the most latest being the Nobel Prize in the last 2 years, Jean Terol. The organizational principles are very clear, and the principles are exactly this: decentralize, professionalize, autonomize, monetize, do not pay non-transparent forms of like plots and houses, etc. Do not pay in those terms. They are non-transparent. They are Dixit calls low-powered incentives, not high-powered incentives, right? Mm-hmm. So these are all very clear, and I think this is the reason I'm trying to summarize it this way is because it's very important for kids to understand, and I hope, Turab, you're teaching this at LUMS, that there is an economic framework by which we can look at things and by which we can convert candles in the dark to daylight everywhere. So that's wonderful. So thank you very much, folks.
Thank you very much.
In parting, I want to ask you a question which I've started asking everybody. Very quickly, can the two of you just give your recommendations, one recommendation of either a book, I'm going to extend it, even a movie, that you think people should either read or watch, and your one or two sentence reasons as to why? Mahmud?
I can mention one book which I read recently, meaning about a year ago, which I really enjoyed. This is a book by Neil Ferguson called The Great Degeneration. I don't know if you've heard about it.
Yep. Go ahead. Tell us about it.
Basically, it's sort of what causes rich countries to lose their way. Symptoms of decline are all around us today. Slow growth, crushing debts, increasing inequality, aging population, antisocial behavior. But he makes the point that these are true, but what is really important is that the institutions, the decline of the institutions and the framework that pulled them together, those are failing the Western societies. And he then looks at China as successful and the US and others on the decline.
Thank you. That's very nice. Turab?
Yeah, I mean, the book, I've talked about it before, which I also use in one of the courses, is Why Nations Fail. I think for economic students, it's an essential read.
It's a must.
And in particular, a chapter which is on the Great Divergence, which I really enjoy reading over and over again. It's how a small island, Great Britain, you know, within a matter of 100-150 years became, literally a world power. So from 1750 till 1850, the story of this remarkable success, you know, is something which I would recommend students to read.
Thank you, Turab. Thank you, Mahmud. It was a wonderful discussion.
Much.
Wish you all the success. Wonderful book. And I would recommend Candles in the Dark to everybody too. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All the best.
Thank you.
सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ